Stocks fell today in response to the fear that higher oil prices could severely cripple the global economy. Yes, it seems to be that fragile. It's the business news headlines for Monday, the 16th day of September. Thanks for being with us, everybody. In other business news, the UAW is striking at General Motors, the first auto strike in 12 years. You wonder why regulators are looking hard at big tech? Well, we've got an Amazon story for you. Big media just got bigger. Purdue Pharma filed for bankruptcy protection. Also today, authors Michael Bornstein and Debbie Bornstein-Hallenstadt are in Iowa talking about the Holocaust and Auschwitz. It's a gripping story. And then Laura Kennard joins me to talk up business events in the Metro. But first, the business news headlines.
Insight on Business, the News Hour, is made possible through the support of the HR professionals at Oasis, a paychecks company at oasisahr.com. Taro International, a company that trains business leaders to be more successful. Achieve, lead, and outclass with Taro. TERO.com. The National Tractor Parts Dealer Association, with members in the United States, Canada, Great Britain, Australia, and New Zealand. NTPDA.com. And AARP, where they work to provide leadership in a host of issues from healthcare to creating more livable communities. Learn more at aarpiowa.org. The business news is next.
Thank you, Hunter Pease, and welcome to the Monday edition of the Business News Hour. I'm your host, Michael Libby. Let's get into it. We've got lots of stuff to cover. Well, the markets fell today as investors and just about everybody else is reacting to the spike in oil prices following an attack on a Saudi oil field over the weekend, which cut oil production there by roughly one half. West Texas Intermediate futures jumped by more than 11% and briefly rose by more than 15% overnight. So why the big deal? Well, for one thing, low oil prices have been a boost to the overall economy. Should consumers start to shell out more of their paycheck just to get around and airlines up their prices and trucking companies increase their rates, well, you get the idea. What is remarkable about this turn of events is how fragile the economy seems to be. Stay tuned. UAW members took to the picket lines against General Motors in what is the first strike against an automaker in 12 years. Workers took to picket lines outside of GM factories, waving signs declaring UAW on strike. During the walkout, UAW members will get about $250 a week from the union's strike fund. The UAW confirmed earlier today that talks had resumed. Lost production could cost GM as much as $40 million to $50 million a day. Now, GM could make up the lost production with overtime work after a settlement. What's the union want? Well, a larger piece of the profit pie that GM has enjoyed over the past decade, and there has been plenty in profits. According to CNN, General Motors has earned tens of billions of dollars in profit over the past 10 years. But the automaker has paid essentially no federal income tax to Washington since it came out of bankruptcy. Now, it isn't that GM is evading Uncle Sam. Federal law allows companies to use past losses to shield future profits from taxes. The tax break, known by the name of net operating loss carry forward, is one of the most common tax breaks in corporate America. Most businesses lose money at some point. The tax break is then designed to help struggling companies get back on their feet. But GM is an extreme example. It suffered huge losses leading up to its 2009 bankruptcy. By 2010, it was again profitable, and it has essentially been very profitable ever since. In case you're wondering, GM posted a total net income of $50 billion between 2010 through 2016, setting company profit records in several periods. And much of the profit has come from savings that the company has enjoyed as they have moved more and more manufacturing out of the United States. Well, the Wall Street Journal is today reporting that Amazon.com has adjusted its product search system to more prominently feature listings that are more profitable for them. That according to some people who said they worked on the project. Late last year, the people said Amazon optimized the secret algorithm that ranks listings so that instead of showing customers mainly the most relevant and best-selling listings when they search the site, it also gives boost to items that are more profitable to Amazon. The adjustment, which the world's biggest online retailer hasn't publicized, followed a years-long battle between executives who run Amazon's retail businesses and the company's search team, which opposed the move. Any tweak to Amazon's search system has broad implications because the giant's rankings can make or break a product. This revelation, if true, underscores why there is such a watchful eye of regulators and Congress on big tech. And if it is true, we're sure there is more to come. Well, today the Federal Communications Commission said it voted to approve Nexstar Media Group's acquisition of Tribune Media in a $6.4 billion deal. The 3-2 vote follows the U.S. Justice Department's announcements back in July that it had approved the deal, saying the companies had to divest television stations in 13 markets to remove antitrust concerns. Nexstar said in December it had agreed to buy Chicago-based Tribune, which would make it the largest regional television station operator in the United States. Well, last week we shared a story that Purdue Pharma was looking to file bankruptcy in an effort to protect itself from a myriad of lawsuits over its manufacture and distribution of OxyContin, long associated with the opioid crisis in the United States. And yesterday, Purdue did file for that protection. The Chapter 11 filing is expected to lead to the ultimate demise of a company that sold a fraction of the opioid prescriptions in the United States, but nevertheless is closely identified with the epidemic because of its pioneering role in the sale of narcotic pain pills. The company, it said, used aggressive, allegedly misleading sales tactics to push physicians to prescribe millions of doses of its dangerously addictive pills. The company's move to seek financial shelter, part of a tentative settlement with thousands of litigants, will now shift the focus to new wrangling over how potential proceeds will be divvied up by communities who are now reeling under the burden of addiction and overdose deaths. This week, Michael Bornstein, who endured the Nazi death camp of Auschwitz as just a 4-year-old boy, made his way back to Iowa along with his daughter, Debbie Hallenstadt, to speak to several groups of adults and children. Michael Bornstein has an Iowa connection, as you'll hear about in just a few moments. We started our conversation talking about hate, the hate he saw then as just a child, and the hate so common today in America, and what he thinks about that.
Yes, there's a lot of anti-Semitism going on. In fact, we're going to be talking to the Anti-Defamation League next week about anti-Semitism. And, you know, we have crimes in synagogues in Pennsylvania and California and even in Iowa. So it's scary.
It is scary. You are a survivor, a very young survivor. As a matter of fact, your photograph of at your liberation, I think it was from the Red Army, has been all over, everywhere. People would recognize that. Did you ever expect in your wildest imagination that you would see neo-Nazis marching in the street in this country?
It's unbelievable, whether it's KKK, neo-Nazi, hate against Muslims, hate against black people, hate against LGBT community. It's scary.
Debbie, you're in the media world yourself. You helped your father write this, and I was watching your presentation, and one of the things I commented to you about while you were signing my book, thank you very much, was the fact that you bring the emotion, I think, to this presentation. Would that be accurate?
Well, I think for a very long time, my dad's survival mechanism, and even still today, is to just stay positive and to focus on the positive aspects of every piece of his life. And so it's hard for him to go back and sort of dig into that the painful parts. And he deflects with just humor, and that's I get it, and I'm proud of him for it. That's survival. That's what survival looks like. But sort of what I'm here to do is sort of facilitate in telling the story so that people get all of the details of the story, the harder parts to tell that are harder for my dad to speak in words. I do that for him so that, you know, he spends more time, as you noticed, focusing on the more positive parts of his life. And that's how he stayed so happy. And, you know.
What was the genesis for this book? Where did this come from? How did you decide to co-author this with your father?
So I've wanted my dad to tell his story for as long as I can remember.
Did he talk about this as a child?
No. Not when I was a child, for sure. And I remember thinking when I was, you know, a teenager, like, oh, one day I'm going to sit down and my dad and I are going to write this story. And, he just didn't want to do it. And so I sort of gave up on the idea. I sort of abandoned it. And then my dad and I were doing some research. We were discussing it again, and we were looking on a website. We Googled children, liberation, and Auschwitz. And it took us to a Holocaust denier's website that was using my dad's picture and some video of him from the liberation of Auschwitz. And it captioned it, you know, these look like pretty healthy children for a, quote, death camp. Or it said, you know, one video was captioned, this shows the lie that Jews have been telling that children were killed on arrival at Auschwitz. And they have, you know, they were manipulating my dad's own images to imply the Holocaust wasn't so bad. And so that was really probably the biggest catalyst, the real fuel that reminded us both this was a project we couldn't let, you know, go by the wayside.
Tell me, your connection with Iowa was the pharmacy school, yes?
That's correct. I started in Iowa in graduate school going for a PhD, and I worked in pharmacy. I have a degree in pharmaceutics, analytical chemistry, and Iowa's been terrific to me. I just want to make one correction. Debola is the author of this book. She really wrote the book. So I just want to be sure you understand what it is.
And I appreciate the Yiddish form of Deborah at the same time. That's pretty neat. What do you want people to take away from your story, Mike?
Well, I think it's important that people understand to be kind to others, to be considerate to others, and get rid of this hate that's going on around the country. We need to be sympathetic, and not every neo-Nazi is good. I just have trouble with that.
Deborah, you made mention during, I think, what was the most poignant part of the presentation, where you had the photograph of your extended family there, and there's a bunch of people.
Yeah.
12 grandkids.
Four
and, you know,
kids,
yeah,
the all,
yeah, exactly. So that was a large family photo. And then you said what?
You can look at that photo and you say, you know, from one survivor, there's 22 in our family. There's all this happiness, and 6 million people were killed. 6 million people that should have had what my dad has, you know, and I think all the time about what would have been today if those 6 million had not died. My father helped develop life-changing, you know, pharmaceuticals, drugs, and he's built this beautiful, wonderful family. You know, each of these survivors, each of these victims should have had the chance to have that life.
I would be remiss. I just happen to remember, Deborah, that this is also a teaching tool, isn't it, for educators?
It is. Survivors Club is being used in schools, in middle schools and high schools around the country, and I cannot tell you how incredible the feedback has been from students and from teachers who say not only are students learning empathy and tolerance and kindness from Survivors Club, but they're also learning optimism. You know, my dad's story is one of tragedy, but it's also one of survival, and this guy who grew up, you know, was a 4-year-old boy with a prisoner uniform on, now has an apartment in New York City and a home in New Jersey and 12 grandkids and, you know, lives this happy, wonderful life. And his story, I think, is inspirational as much as it is educational.
Thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The book is called Survivors Club, the true story of a very young prisoner of Auschwitz. We'll have links to their website on our radio blog.